some data for the production of wheat in England and rice in Japan, and you see it rising almost exponentially over the last 25 years particularly. These really are dramatic increases by any standard. But when we get down to this, the matter looks very curious indeed. Could I have the next slide, please? We take the case of the wheat in England, and we see, yes, the yield has gone up in that dramatic way, but the total energy we've put into the crop in the form of herbicides, pesticides, fungicides, fertilizers, has gone up in direct proportion. So we haven't actually gained anything. Now, those increases in yield are due about 50% to improved agronomy and 50% to breeding activities. And when you get down to the breeding activities, you find that what has happened is that in the last 50 years, the amount of dry matter being produced in our wheat per unit area of ground has remained constant. What the breeder has done has shunted a bigger proportion of it into the grain, so that we haven't achieved any breakthrough in actually causing the crop to produce more in a given area of ground. And if you set this against the current situation with world population trends, 4 billion in 1975, 6.35 billion by the year 2000, and 10.1 billion by the year 2030 on present trends, then it's perfectly clear that no amount of genetic engineering is going to cope with that appalling situation. Now, at this point, I wish to change gear. We've seen how adaptation can work and how we might begin to modify it. But now I want you to ascend for a while with me to a modern Mount Olympus, a sort of satellite, if you would, to use a more contemporary imagery. And from this vantage point outside the Earth, I want us to give ourselves a brief space away from the hurly-burly and excitement of this new genetic technology to try and see something of its wider implications. From this position, we can ask, for example, well, if this is what special selection can do, as we've seen with those poultry, to which we are now adding genetic engineering, and if this is the way we can alter our cultivated plants and domestic animals, what then will be the impact on Homo sapiens? What, in short, are we likely to be doing to ourselves? Now, in order to get into this, let's consider briefly a few of the things which we've started to do, and then indulge in a modest degree of speculation. First of all, there's artificial insemination by donor. This has made it possible, away from the taboos of promiscuity, to distribute widely the spermatozoa of selected males, and one has heard of fatuous Nobel laureates such as Shockley putting themselves, as it were, on the market for this purpose. Now, this possibility of favouring a particular genotype is now further reinforced because of improved techniques of cold storage of semen. Bulls which died 10 years ago are still fathering calves in dairy herds around this nation and many parts of the world. But not with humans, you might say. But yes, take the case of Mrs. Kim Casale. In 1977, she gave birth to a third son by her husband, who had died of an incurable disease 17 months earlier. Before he died, Mrs. Casale had persuaded her husband to provide her with a sample of his semen for her subsequent use. It was kept in cold storage and 8 months after his death used to artificially inseminate Mrs. Casale, and she duly produced a son, a third child. Now, this is an isolated case, it's true, but it could become more frequent when one considers legal issues, desirability of having an heir, for example, in various complicated situations. It could make a small but real contribution to changing the pattern of gene flow in the population. Let us next consider the case of Louise Brown. This little girl, I think, will be familiar to you all as the first child to be born as the product of in vitro fertilization of egg and sperm, followed by implantation back into the mother. Since no change of parentage is involved in this case, gene flow in the population is not greatly altered, except to the extent that an offspring is born to parents who wouldn't previously have been contributing to succeeding generations. But it's the further implications of this technology which widen the prospects substantially. Firstly, one may find that the fertilization in vitro goes well for some couples, but not for others. So why not ask the successful parents to help their less fortunate colleagues by inviting them to donate eggs and semen to be fertilized in vitro and then given to another couple for whom this technique hasn't worked, for them to raise? This is a humane act which could be the beginning of genetic selection in favor of ex utero fertilizability. Now, this may seem fanciful, but while we're in this vein, imagine the commercial possibilities for popular people who would cash in on their fame. And one can imagine at the dispensary, for example, we'd like Elvis with Linda Lovelace for our second theme. Now, this altering of the pattern, well, hero worship does go this way, you know, very often. The number of people I've met who dote on Elvis is quite distressing, and I'm sure that if they had had the possibility of bearing Elvis's infants, had that worthy chosen to put himself on the market, it would have happened. And this, of course, will alter the pattern of gene flow and would be further reinforced if historical figures with their gametes in gene banks become available. Now, the next step, of course, is cloning. By this, I mean removing the nucleus from the egg of a female and putting in its place a diploid nucleus from an ordinary somatic cell of an adult. It's nearly 30 years since this was first successfully done by implanting nuclei from the intestinal cells of frogs into enucleate frog ova. But there are now claims, and I must say this is a matter of discreditable scientific publication, which suggests that this is achieved in mammals. I don't think it's actually true, but it has been claimed. And I'm sure it's only a matter of a very short time before it's successful. But the claim has been made in a publication in Cell 2 years ago that it's possible to take blastocysts from mice, to take the nuclei and put those into a zygote from which one removes the fertilization nucleus, and put this back into, culture it up into a new blastula in vitro, put this back into a mouse, and so get the clone individual bearing just the nucleus of one parent. Could we have the next slide, please? This shows the technology, putting the nucleus in and removing the micronuclei. Next slide, please. Shows you the coloured pictures that were produced to claim that this had been done. I want to gloss over this because it does look as though this was actually an example of scientific charlatanism, but nonetheless, it is clearly only just round the corner as a matter of technology. Now, the speculative extension of this theme to the case of man was very entertainingly developed, of course, by Ira Levin in his book The Boys from Brazil, and in much more dubious circumstances by David Rovick in his deceptive book, In His Image, in which he contended that he had acted as the middleman for a Californian millionaire in finding scientists who, for a very generous fee, were prepared to clone him, thereby providing an heir. There's nothing to suggest, though, that this technology is but a very short time away. You may say it's absurd that anyone should wish to do it, but let's look at the medical aspects. Imagine a family, for example, in which the husband is diagnosed as having an incurable kidney disease. Graft incompatibility and lack of a donor mean that he must die. If one could clone, then the way forward would be to take an egg from the wife, enucleate it, as we have seen, put a nucleus from the male, the husband, who's seriously ill, into the wife's egg, re-implant, let the fetus develop until it's developed near-functional kidneys, and at the appropriate stage abort the fetus and graft the required kidney into the father. Well, yes, you might say, I'm dubious about this, but supposing that 4 or 5 months into the pregnancy, the wife decides that she'd rather have the infant that she's carrying than her husband. Then, of course, she goes off, he dies, and a very short time later, the first cloned human is born. But there are other more compelling possibilities. Take, for example, the group of genetic disorders which are of a recessive nature and carried on the X chromosome, haemophilia and Duchenne muscular dystrophy. These are two examples. So that if the mother is a carrier, there's a 50% chance of her sons having the disease. The present route to having children is to adopt, or if one wants healthy children of one's own, to have male fetuses aborted as soon as they can be determined. But an alternative route to a healthy male child would be to clone in a diploid nucleus from the father. Now, if all this is relatively crude stuff, but it'll be specialized and expensive technology for some time to come, might militate against its widespread adoption. But clearly, these things are going to get easier all the time with practice. And it represents nothing like the limit of these genetic manipulations which can modify our gene pool. We've glimpsed at the work on transposable elements and other integrating vectors. Now we're in a position to chop up the chromosomes of man into smaller pieces using restriction enzymes, clone the fragments using plasmids in bacteria, and from this library of cloned pieces, we can fish out the bits encoding particular genes by hybridization techniques and introduce these into the cells of the person in whom a particular gene is defective. This is a technology which is being very rapidly developed. This form of defective enzyme therapy will certainly become available, and although it represents a much smaller scale of interference with the gene pool and the genome, it'll almost certainly be practiced on a much wider scale. And if you couple this technology with some of the more recent progress with in vitro fertilization that I've referred to, it'll become possible to take a few cells from an in vitro blastula, check out whether they've got defective genes or not, and then implant the rest of the blastula, which can still form a normal individual even though it lost a few cells early on. Now, any frank assessment of all this makes it clear that we're only at the beginning of what must become an increasingly powerful and sensitive set of tools. These tools will become increasingly attractive to all young people who consider themselves at risk in a genetic sense, and it won't take a very big shift in the social ethos to yield a general adoption of these practices. The scale of the manipulations increases, and the makeup of the gene pool is modified accordingly. Now, these possibilities lead to some interesting considerations in respect of the rate of evolutionary change within our species, since the evolution of a species through time is a consequence of the changes in its gene pool. Now, it's the generally accepted view that most of the change along lineages is a gradual and cumulative process. Phyletic gradualism is the jargon of evolutionists. On this view, if one is able to obtain a complete fossil record of an evolving lineage, and then what it looks like is a continuously graded series of forms which through time converges in appearance to some descendant species and looks less and less similar to the ancestral form. When there are gaps in the fossil record, they're held to be the result of either a failure in the deposition of fossils or in failure to discover them. But perhaps the most notorious such gap is in the early emergence of flowering plants, the so-called angiosperms, which appear very suddenly in the early Cretaceous. But if one talks to paleontologists studying many different groups of organisms, you find that they're all haunted by gaps in their evolutionary series at various points. Now, arising out of this situation, the notion of phyletic gradualism has come to be challenged by an alternative hypothesis that a substantial proportion of the totality of evolutionary change occurs not by gradual change, but by rapid bursts of morphological and speciation interspersed with long periods when there's nothing much happening at all. And when such bursts do occur, they occur in small marginal populations so that the altered genes spread quickly and opportunities for fossil deposition are greatly reduced. This concept is referred to as punctuated equilibrium. Now, currently there exists a very lively controversy as to whether the evolution of hominids has followed a gradualistic course or whether it's been a punctuated process. And I should like to look briefly at this, which is summarized in the next three slides. We have this sequence in the so-called gracile hominids leading up to man. Could I have the next slide, please? And there has particularly been a problem in relating this fossil, STS5, could I have the next slide, please, to Chukutien. The first one, if you imagine this as one continuous series. In point of fact, go back again please, recently there have been discovered these intermediate forms, 1470, 1813 and 3733, which do begin to fill in what looks a little more like a series. However, what I want you to just do is to look again at what is my last slide. Could I have that next one back again, please? Because you'll see that I've doctored it a bit by putting in a dotted line. And this is because since I prepared this note, another paper has appeared on the Petrolona skull there, which using electron spin resonance techniques has brought this skull up to only 160,000 years old. Now, if one takes along with this some biochemical evidence concerning the antiquity of man, derived from the degree of variation in the sequence of nucleotide bases in the mitochondrial genome, this puts the species at about 130,000 years old, so that you see the gap is closing very rapidly between modern Homo sapiens and Petrolona, and moreover, in terms of geological time, it's beginning to look very rapid indeed. Now, I've referred this problem in order that we can, from our Olympian perch, ask, what are the implications? Is there a suggestion from this, then, that our species may be indeed embroiled in a punctuated phase, in which it's evolving very rapidly, and that this punctuated phase may not, in fact, have reached its peak? And from the suggestions of the rapid origin that these fossils afford, we now add the fact that we are positively beginning to interfere in the gene pool, and you can see that the possibilities for more rapid evolution are becoming ever greater. But remember also that the rate of evolution depends also on the intensity of the selection pressure, as we saw with men selecting out the peculiar poultry, for example. And this raises the question of the new selection pressures arising from our changing environment. Could I have the next, the lights up, please. Now, this is where I want to finally focus. We've seen how, in a relatively short time, selection can alter the characteristics of plants and animals under domestication, as Darwin analysed in great detail, and we've seen from our slides of maize and poultry. And we've seen how genetic engineering can revolutionise domesticated stock by introducing these improbable combinations. So in the case of man, we can ask, what of the combined effects of genetic engineering and the accelerating environmental change, which we broadly term civilization? How will this affect our adaptation? This brings us to some very murky water indeed, into which my more rigorous colleagues will already be urging that I have gone too far. But I warned you that I was going to talk on a broad canvas. The first important point is that when we are considering evolution and selection in a species capable of intelligent behaviour, the subtleties of response can be of such complexity that they'll be impossible to unravel. The following little tale will just illustrate this. Can you imagine a New England fold yard in which the farm is built around the square? And can you imagine one day a group of Rhode Island red fowls in there, and a young cockerel comes up to the old one who has ruled the flock of hens for several years and says, "Oi, get out." And the old boy says, "What do you mean, get out? These are my flock, my hens." "No, you're finished. Right off. Get out." So the old cockerel says, "Oh, now just wait a minute, old boy, don't be so rushed. If you think I'm done for, let's have a little competition. I'll just give me 2 yards start, that's all I ask for, and we'll race twice round this barn, and if you can catch me, then I'll agree that you are now the fitter man." See this business of fitness coming in again. "And you can take over the flock, I'll go away." So imagine the sun streaming in by the doorway of the barn, they're racing round, and as they suddenly go past the door, with the young cockerel already gaining on the old boy, breathing down his neck, a shot rings out, and the young cockerel falls down dead. And we look out into the yard, and there the farmer is leaning on the barrel of his still smoking gun. And he turns to his wife and says, "It's a funny thing, Alice, that's the second queer young rooster I've shot this week." Now, you can see that the subtleties of tactic when one comes to intelligent organisms, that tale incidentally was told me by a psychologist, do indicate that we're into a very complicated subject indeed. But the direction in which we're headed is the central problem of sociobiology. What is the nature and significance of the genetic component in our behaviour as individuals and as organisms adapted to having a level of social behaviour? It's a topic which many professional geneticists shun like the plague, and for good reasons. They emphasise the lack of evidence and the difficulties in applying acceptable standards of experimental science to the problem. And moreover, it leads to the discussion of the inheritance of intellectual traits and of racial attributes, which intrude into the domain of polemic and political philosophy, which are viewed with both suspicion and distaste. But I think I ought to make my position here absolutely plain. I'm not in any doubt that there is a strong heritable component in the human nervous system, as in any other living tissue. And I think it probable that this extends to intellectual attributes such as intelligence. I think, moreover, that we shall discover its material base, probably in the proteins which comprise the neurotransmitter fibers in synaptic junctions and in the production of different quantities of synaptic transmitter substances. I can see no reason why these components should not be under polymorphic control, as are the attributes of other tissues in all organisms. These variables will lead to individual differences in the capacity for information processing. But that is not to say that the genetic component is preeminent in the totality of the makeup of an individual. And it's here that I want to highlight what I regard as one of the most pernicious developments of the past decade, the rise of sociobiology, particularly in the hands of E.O. Wilson and his colleagues at Harvard. This is, to my mind, an appallingly dangerous development, and I say dangerous in that it purports to be a branch of biological science, whereas in reality it's nothing of the sort. It's pseudoscience of the worst possible kind. One of the prevailing errors in sociobiology is the free use of analogy. If we consider, for example, the work of Lorentz, it leaves us in little doubt that many species, various aspects of aggression and courtship and sexual activity and social activity, are programmed genetically in some degree. And it's easy, therefore, to drift into the facile error of supposing that in man also these types of attribute are natural qualities inherited from our pre-human ancestors, homologous to the situation in other species. A specimen of this type of approach in sociobiology would go something like this. We began living in small groups as hunters, in which state powers of communication were at an advantage. This led to the evolution of language, which permitted the social tightening of the groups. Language also contributed to social organization for defense, then agriculture, and then the transmission of accumulated experience to succeeding generations. With the evolution of the mind, the power of language, and the transmission of experience, that developed the environmentally orientated taboos, which reinforced the cohesion of the group and led to the ostracism of aberrant individuals. In due course, the taboos gave rise to theistic religions, even more potent forces for the maintenance of a social order. Another example, we may take the case of aggression as particularly instructive. Ethologists will argue that we are descended from territorial ancestors who have contributed to the genetic source of what is possessive, warlike, and similarly unpleasant in our behavior. Added to this is the notion that we have evolved ritualized submissive gestures which stay the hand of the aggressor, sort of good soldier Schweik syndrome. And they go on to infer that modern depersonalized warfare presents the expression of this type of behavior. Now the problem in all this, of course, is that where's the hard evidence? And it seems to me that there never will be any hard evidence. For a large part of it's a pack of cards, a house built of cards on the flimsiest foundations. And the reason why I think that there are no firm foundations is that these arguments fail to take account of the capacity for what I will call generalized forms of behavior, which have become possible as the evolution of the brain has taken place. Now, I'll attempt to explain what I mean by generalized behavior another example from plants. You take this one here. Very dear lady in the audience called Maureen Kelly, whose happy birthday present this is. She doesn't know it's here, but there it is. But this is an example of a plant, an epiphytic fern, which is very specialized. It can't change its style much. It occurs in nature in only a few very special niches in the branches of trees where it's able to grow. But if you take this plant, which I collected in the grounds, this occurs over most of the globe. And it's capable of altering its form so that you'd be forgiven for thinking that these were different species. And even within a given genotype, you have this incredible plasticity, this capacity for a generalized sort of behavior. And what I am seeking to argue here is that if we revert to the case of man, there can be no doubt that the development of the brain has provided the basis for another form of plasticity, like the one shown in these plants, where the plant shows this morphological plasticity in relation to environment, man can show the cultural flexibility. But no more. The various patterns of human cultural behavior that have emerged in different civilizations and in different geographical regions are simply examples of the almost infinite spread of different possible manifestations of cultural pattern, which the acquisition of the nerve net, the brain, has made possible. It's like, as it were, the vast range of sonatas that becomes possible once one has evolved a good piano. But these different cultural manifestations are not themselves genetically fixed. And this is where Wilson and his crew have gone so wide of the mark. Now this, of course, throws the central emphasis in human behavioral development back onto environmental factors. And for some people, particularly those with a rather specifically doctrinaire religious and political commitments, there is a certain solace to be found in this rescue from an overemphasis on the genetic determinist nature of the hammer of our fate. But this is, I suspect, to court just as serious a delusion as does much of sociobiology on the determinist side. Certainly, in the argument I've just outlined, I've conceded a great deal to the environmentalist position. But I want to warn, firstly, that the genetics will keep on reappearing, as in evidence for the inheritance of abilities in psychomotor tests, disposition to schizophrenia, and so on. But accepting the greater environmental component in the moulding of our behaviour, it may be argued, represent an even bleaker prospect in man's future than if it were left to the tender, determinative mercies of our genetic constitution. Because As with the plant that we've just seen, in which the ability to manifest this range of forms requires that there be environmental diversity to induce them, so with man, we must ask what will be his capacity for the development of individuality and self-expression if we go on progressively unifying our physical and cultural environment. And it's here that we encounter the great paradox that it seems to me has bedeviled mankind throughout his cultural history, a paradox which intensifies as our social organization becomes elaborated. On the one hand, there's the need for a wellspring of individuality and innovation generated in a cultural and educational diversity, whilst on the other, there is the degree of ordered behavior and conformity which will best serve the economic and social equilibrium of the society. And it's this paradox, of course, which confounds both our political institutions and our cultural endeavors. It's manifest in opposed political philosophies and appears as a source of tension in much of modern art and literature. I view with great misgiving those political systems whose ethic places the emphasis of power in the mindless right of an elected majority. And in equal measure, I dislike those political systems which, in the name of competition in its commercial sense, iron out our landscape to endless horizons of maize, wheat and barley, interspersed with tower blocks for people and further blocks for the hypermarkets to which those people must attend for their sole source of one variety of daily bread. Now, T.S. Eliot, of course, saw the bankruptcy of these modern developments in society and cried out against them in The Wasteland. Dostoevsky confronted the problem in a particularly penetrating way in his great novel, The Brothers Karamazov. You remember Ivan's poem, The Grand Inquisitor, in which the aged cardinal in medieval Seville confronts at midnight a prisoner who he fears is Christ, but he isn't sure. This young man had been taken during the day healing people in the old part of the town by the laying on of hands. And the old cardinal goes in and confronts the young man and says to him, "You want to go into the world and you're going empty-handed with some promise of freedom, which men in their simplicity and their innate lawlessness cannot even comprehend, which they fear and dread, for nothing has ever been more unendurable to man and to human society than freedom. Do you know that ages will pass and mankind will proclaim in its wisdom and science that there is no crime and therefore no sin, but only hungry people? Feed them first and then demand virtue of them. That is what they will inscribe on their banner, which they will raise against you and which will destroy your temple," the temple of freedom, that is. When you think that this was written 40 years before the Russian Revolution, it's pretty prophetic. This tension, which has served as the wellspring of masterpieces in literature such as this, has its roots in our genetically derived individuality, on which are superimposed the unifying pressures to conform within society. But the wholeness of life at the level of the individual and the vigor of society require that there should be diversity in our environment and freedom of action in our society. The history of Western society bears abundant testimony to the role which our universities have to play as bastions of independent thought and individual enterprise. Increasingly, these values are called in question. Central governments seek, on an unprecedented scale, to dictate what we shall do. Often they seek to channel funds into government-favored areas of research and those only. In these circumstances, we must increasingly look to our universities as outposts for the defense against the tyrannic pressures to conformity in economic, political, and social life, so that our evolution can go a proper, wider course. I was tempted to invoke T.S. Eliot again for a final reinforcement of my argument, but as I thought about this, it was another American voice that came into my mind instead. Robert Frost, an old record of whose, reading his own poetry, I used to treasure in childhood, and particularly when he wrote as follows. are when in the heart of man, was it ever less than a treason to go with the drift of things and yield with a grace to reason and bow and accept the end of a love or a season? Thank you.